Welcome to Computing Lives, a podcast from the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. The Annals publishes stories of technological innovation, stories of commerce, stories of computing institutions, and stories of computing people. This podcast is a biography of one of the pioneers of the computing field, Jack Kilby. It's drawn from the January 2007 issue of The Annals. Jack Kilby, 1923 to 2005. Jack St. Clair Kilby was born in Jefferson City, Missouri, on the 8th of November, 1923, to Vina Freitag and Herbert St. Clair Kilby. His parents, both born on small farms near Mackinac, a small central Illinois town, attended the same country school and later graduated from the University of Illinois. Vina worked as a dietitian before marriage. Herbert graduated in 1914 with a degree in electrical engineering. When Jack was four, the family moved to Salina, Kansas, where his father was general manager and, soon president, of the Kansas Power Company. Part of the Samuel Insull Utilities empire, Kansas Power operated small generating plants across the western part of the state. When Jack was 10, his parents took him to the Century of Progress World's Fair in Chicago. Most memorable was the World of Tomorrow section, featuring models of futuristic cities, automobiles, and superhighways, plus a locomotive with parts of the shell removed to expose the mechanisms and a cable-suspended skyride across the lagoon. He realized that in the future, things would be different, and that I wanted to be part of that difference. As Jack grew up, he understood that if he went away to college, he almost certainly wouldn't come back to Western Kansas, where few interesting jobs would be available, especially in engineering. Soon his father took him along during summers to visit the company's power plants. "I wanted to know how they worked and why they worked," Jack recalled. Jack's father was a hands-on manager, and together they crawled through machinery to see what had gone wrong with an old armature, or to see how well a new transformer was working. He came to internalize his father's off-stated definition of an engineer, a person who can do for $1 what any damn fool can do for two. Jack was not involved in sports. His hobbies were more of the mind than physical. From about age 8, he liked to take things apart. Old wind-up clocks, radios, broken toys. He began doing minor electrical repairs around the house, replacing a cord or trying to fix a toaster. After the Kilbys had spent nearly a decade in Salina, the Kansas Power relocated its main offices to another Kansas County seat, Great Bend. Hubert Kilby believed that the job of running Kansas Power also involved advertising the product. Inspired by all the latest electrical devices with which his father had furnished the house, he recalled it was a course in invention appreciation, Jack continued tinkering. His father encouraged Jack's tinkering by bringing home magazines such as Popular Science and Popular Mechanics, and eventually by bringing home from work magazines for electrical engineers and books on the utility industry. Following some instructions he'd found, Jack decided to make an arc light. He extracted the carbon electrodes from some flashlight batteries, put them in a crock of salt water, and attached them to a plug, which he plugged into a wall socket. On one attempt, he blew out most of the fuses of the house, but his parents saw this as a learning process and encouraged him anyway. Jack first began to experiment with electronics as a result of the Great Blizzard of 1937, when he was 13. Jack's father had to deal with problems all over the region, so he arranged with some local ham radio operators to establish communication. He visited their radio shacks to talk directly with the operatives in other towns. Jack went along, and the hams would let the boy twist the dials, rotate the antenna, and put on the earphones to hear the incoming signals. "It was impressive, and I was intrigued," he recounted later. When the emergency was over, Jack struck up a friendship with two of the hams, both about 10 years older than he, one a radio and appliance repairman, the other a power company employee. They tutored him on the intricacies of radio and Morse code, encouraged him to seek his own license, and guided him through the ham manual until he could build a low-wattage, one-tube transmitter from mail-order parts. Jack would often stay up half the night when the signals were clear, sending code on his key and receiving it through his headset. He reached fellow hams all over the country and sometimes as far as Cuba or Hawaii. By his early high school years, his ham work had convinced him that he indeed wanted to become an electrical engineer. Soon, he said, it seemed to me that there were other things more interesting than the utility business, and he never considered anything but electronics again. For both Jack and his younger sister, Jane, books were an important part of growing up in the Kilby household. Both parents, first in their families to graduate from college, very much appreciated the value of their university experience, Jack reported. Its importance was never questioned. It was always understood that we would go to college. By the time Jack entered high school, he wore glasses and was approaching his full height of 6'6". He generally got B grades, but mastered the basics without any of his math or science teachers strongly inspiring him. He remembered a history teacher as his biggest academic inspiration. She taught that events had important causes and effects, and she challenged Jack to live up to his high capabilities. Though the family did not need the money, Jack was expected to take summer jobs. One year he shoveled wheat. Another year his father helped him find a job in the power plant of a neighboring company, where he cleaned thick tar out of a large hot oil tank. This experience, he observed later, contributed to a feeling that I didn't want to do manual labor. Throughout high school, Jack never considered any college except the mecca of engineering schools, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It was the only place he applied. Before graduation in 1941, he took the college board exam. He knew he had some weaknesses in math, but he was still surprised when he fell far short of the 500 score that MIT required. He took the train for Cambridge, attended a month-long refresher course at MIT, and took the exam again. When the results were announced in August, he had scored 497, 3 points short. Decades later, he would still remember the pain, the score, and the specific algebra problems that had tripped him up. New college terms were scheduled to start in a week, and he still had not applied anywhere else. There were no colleges in Kansas he considered adequate for an aspiring engineer. Fortunately, his father was a successful alumnus of the electrical engineering program at the University of Illinois, and had kept in touch with many of its professors. Without Jack's ever formally applying, he and his father went to Champaign, visited the department, and walked through the enrollment process. Jack's first 2 years were rather routine, covering standard engineering subjects, since specialization in electrical subjects was held off until the junior and senior years. Much of the time, he was still smarting from his rejection by MIT. You just kinda did what you were supposed to. 3 months after Jack enrolled, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and by the end of his freshman year, he had signed up for the enlisted reserve corps. At the end of his sophomore year, he was finally called up and made a corporal in the Signal Corps. He went through radio operators training school and was assigned to the Organization of Strategic Services, the predecessor of the Central Intelligence Agency. He was stationed at an Army radio repair shop on a converted tea plantation in northeastern India, a few miles from the border with Burma. From there, small groups of American guerrillas were being airlifted over the mountainous hump to arm and organize Burmese resistance to the Japanese. His own role was to maintain a couple dozen transmitters and to set them up with the right radio frequencies to contact the men in the field. When General Stilwell's forces finally fought their way into Burma and linked up with Allied forces in China, Jack's group followed. He spent the last 6 months of the war inside China. Looking back on the experience, he felt that he had matured a lot more than the time would have suggested, and learned to live with other adults outside of a school environment. When challenges came, he found himself being stretched to do many things he had never done before. And if you did them, he said, and they worked out, you gained from them. The work's frequent tedium provided a crash course in the value of education. Jack returned to his studies with an increased determination. Most of his expenses at Illinois were now covered by the GI Bill of Rights. More self-confident, he looked forward to pursuing his specific interest in electricity and electronics, but his experience was generally disappointing. Other parts of the university offered courses that might have excited him, subjects like quantum and solid-state physics, but they weren't going to expose that funny stuff to simple-minded engineers. Instead, he found an electrical engineering department in transition between the older preoccupation with power engineering and the newer interest in electronics. The tenured faculty were all power engineers, including some excellent teachers who taught Jack to analyze a problem and work through it. By contrast, most instructors in the limited number of new electronics courses were veterans of wartime radio or radar stations and lacked strong teaching skills. There were no assistantships available to undergraduates, and he never became close to any of his professors. By the time Kilby graduated in 1947, his greatest strength was not his grades, respectable, but not exceptional. But the fact that, unlike most of his classmates, he had an idea of what he wanted to do. He wanted to work in electronics as an engineer with the vague thought that he might someday start his own business. Kilby's first task was to find a job, so he wrote letters to every electronics company he had heard of, 30 in all. He ended up with three offers. General Electric and Illinois Bell didn't interest him because he couldn't be sure they would involve him in interesting problems in electronics. He was intrigued, however, by the experimental work at Centralab, a relatively obscure operation in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was the electronics division of a larger company, Globe Union, mostly engaged in making automobile parts. Soon after joining Central Lab, he married Barbara Anningers, whom he had met on a blind date at Illinois, where she was studying speech therapy. Over the next few years, they had two daughters. Central Lab itself had about 40 engineers, but Kilby joined a smaller group of 7 or 8 who were developing new ideas. The challenge the Central Lab engineers faced was on the cutting edge of electronics production. Components like carbon resistors and metal or porcelain capacitors had traditionally been built separately and then hand-wired together in circuits. During World War II, Central Lab's engineers, led by Harry W. Rubinstein, developed the first printed circuit board, replacing wires with lines of silver paint printed by a silk screen onto a ceramic base. As the post-war civilian electronics market was opening up, a new team was seeking ways to print the components as well. Inductors might be included as spirals of silver paint. Resistors added as patches of carbon paint. Whole circuits might be printed in a single set of manufacturing processes and, when vacuum tubes were attached, used in hearing aids, radios, or television sets. So small an operation had few rules, and even the most junior engineer was soon assigned important problems. That little company would prove to be, he reflected later, the best place in the country to prepare him for his later challenges. The head of Central Lab's R&D, Alfred S. Khoury, had a knack for breaking large tasks down into manageable parts, Kilby recalled, and he was patient and tolerant when first results were sometimes less than perfect. Both Khoury and Central Lab's chief engineer, Robert Wolf, were very capable and very supportive of new ideas. The physical layout, with engineering and manufacturing all under one roof, contributed to a hands-on kind of environment in which you could see what kind of problems you were causing or trying to fix. The intensity of competition in the business also provided sort of a crash course in the sensitivity to cost. Kilby would read everything he could find about a particular field and also attended extension classes in Milwaukee to earn a master's degree in electrical engineering from the University of Wisconsin. He even devoured material as obscure as a dental supply catalog. When the lab needed to pare down each of its printed carbon resistors to exactly the same size, Kilby remembered a small tool for sandblasting away tooth decay and tracked it down and found it was just right for the job. In 1948, Bell Labs announced the invention of the transistor, and Kilby was immediately intrigued. A year or so later, he attended a lecture at Milwaukee's Marquette University by one of its inventors, John Bardeen, who told how the small, solid device could replace the large, fragile vacuum tube. When Bell Labs agreed to issue licenses for transistor production, Central Lab bought one and sent Kilby, along with Wolf, to a two-week course at Bell. He returned to Milwaukee, excited by many new ideas, and soon he was running a small project to manufacture germanium transistors, improving both the products and the process as he went along. He also helped develop a better transistorized hearing aid, incorporating in its printed circuits a new kind of capacitor that he had invented. In Kilby's 10 years at Central Lab, its products proved only moderately profitable, but he had filed a dozen patents. He later looked back on the spiral of success. His first inventions were recognized and acknowledged, and I was patted on the back for them. In the process, an interviewer wrote, Kilby fell in love with the intense creative process of identifying a problem, working through dozens of possible approaches, and finding a solution. He had discovered the sheer joy of inventing. As Kilby came to realize some of his own potential, he also saw the limitations of what Central Lab was doing and where it was going. The company's aging owner had become far less venturesome, and engineers found it far easier to develop ideas in the lab than to see them become new products. To Kilby, transistors were clearly the wave of the future, but in other companies, they were increasingly being made from heat-tolerant silicon rather than germanium, and Central Lab management was unwilling to invest in the transition. More important, a serious engineering problem needed to be solved. Engineers might design circuits to be squeezed into smaller and smaller spaces, but production workers still had to make each transistor separately and solder it into place. The larger the number of components, the more connectors the design required, the harder it was to build the product, and the longer it took for electrons to travel along the circuits. Kilby, like many other engineers, defined the creation of smaller circuits as the frontier problem in electronics. He started writing to firms with enough resources to seriously address the problem. He interviewed with IBM and had a job offer from Motorola, but finally accepted a job from the younger, smaller firm of Texas Instruments, TI, in Dallas, Texas. Having recently pioneered transistor radios and silicon transistors, it was now the world's largest producer, and its transistor research team, under Willis Adcock, had many times the engineers and equipment of Central Lab. To Kilby, Adcock and his group looked like they were more nearly prepared to move and to do something differently. To Adcock, Kilby looked like a very serious engineer indeed, who would fit right into our plans. By May 1958, when Kilby arrived in Dallas, Adcock's group was working on an Army project called the Micromodule, a flat electronic component that would be snapped together, an approach he considered uninteresting. too new to qualify for a company's scheduled 2-week vacation, he was left alone in the lab one summer, and determined to come up with an interesting enough idea that he could avoid the micro-module project. He had 10 years of experience at printing circuits with the connectors and most of the components made of paints with different additives. He knew that TI's great competitive strength was in silicon. Its weakness? Its high costs of assembly. He soon realized that the best product for TI required no wiring. A single wafer of silicon containing the necessary components such as diodes, resistors, capacitors, transistors, and connectors. For each component, the industry already had a favorite material, but Kilby reckoned that each could also be made from a silicon alloy. Diodes and transistors were already being made in silicon, doped with special impurities to give them just enough conductivity. And a section of pure silicon might serve as a resistor. Individually, these might not be the best components, but they might all be made small and squeezed together in a small chip of silicon with connections between them in or added on the surface. By the time Adcock and the others returned to work, Kilby had sketched such a chip and his plans for building it. The idea for a chip seemed pretty damn cumbersome, Adcock recalled, but nonetheless, he encouraged Kilby to proceed. First, Kilby built separate resistors and capacitors from silicon, just to show that the circuit elements could be made from semiconducting materials. Then he built an oscillator circuit on a square wafer, only 0.4 inch wide, with gold wires attached for connectors. By the 12th of September, he was ready to try a demonstration. He nervously hooked up the wafer between a battery and an oscilloscope, and suddenly the screen displayed a line with perfectly regular sine waves. The world's first monolithic integrated circuit, IC, had worked. A few months later, Robert Noyce at Fairchild Semiconductor would independently develop another form of integrated circuit. He and Kilby are commonly given comparable standing as inventors of the chip. Both Adcock and TI's president, Patrick Haggerty, enthusiastically supported further development of the chip. The company announced the device as no larger than a matchhead and persuaded the U.S. Air Force to share development costs for its use in a small computer on the Minuteman missile. Over a 10-year period, the chip idea had to be sold to the company, moved into production, and incorporated into new applications. And that work was really more important than the invention itself. By 1962, TI was selling commercial versions of the integrated circuit, and Kilby led a growing Texas Instrument group engineering newer versions of it. TI eventually led the world in semiconductor production. Kilby then added another landmark to the history of technology. Haggerty then challenged him with 3 possible new civilian uses for Texas Instruments integrated circuits. 2 of them, including a tape recorder no bigger than a lipstick, Kilby considered impractical. The 3rd, however, a battery-operated handheld calculator, was one I thought I had a chance to do. He led a 3-man team to solve the various problems, designing a small keyboard, finding a way to display and print the results, and building more complex chips to perform the functions. One of his many personal contributions was invented a lightly heated printing head that could create images on heat-sensitive paper. When TI offered its first Pocketronic calculators in 1971, they weighed only 2.5 pounds and sold for $250, 1/5 the cost of a much bulkier desktop model. Within 2 decades, 100 million calculators were being sold worldwide every year. Most were far lighter and more powerful than Kilby's original model, and some sold for 1/100th of its price. Kilby stayed at Texas Instruments for a dozen years, the last two of them as assistant vice president and director of engineering. Finding his assignments increasingly less interesting, he took leave of absence in 1970 to operate as an independent inventor and consultant, eventually bringing his patent total above 60. During the 1970s energy crisis, he developed a rooftop device to collect and store solar energy in masses of silicon pellets, each no bigger than the head of a pin. Texas Instrument brought the rights, and he spent several years consulting on it. He demonstrated that the system could work, but when the world price of oil collapsed later in the decade, the company abandoned the effort. In 1981, Kilby's wife died. In the aftermath, an interviewer found him leading a happy but somewhat solitary life, thinking, reading, reading, and thinking. His post-Texas Instrument years were marked by a certain frugality and resistance to new technologies, even those he had personally advanced. For years, he refused to use either a computer or even a handheld calculator, preferring to stick with a log-log desatrig slide rule. He favored watches with hands to the newer digital ones controlled by integrated circuits. Into his 70s, he was still working because I enjoy it, he said. He increasingly focused on consulting and served on the boards of several companies, including electronic component marketer Weil Laboratories. But he was also still inventing things, including an electronic checkbook. Characteristically, he declined to use one himself. As work grew less demanding, he spent more time on photography, an early interest, and a new hobby of woodworking. Kilby later reflected that his problem-solving drive had been far more important than money as a career motivator. He never became fabulously rich at Texas Instrument, but attained the ability to live comfortably, to do whatever he wanted. He bought himself a Mercedes, but kept it for a couple of decades and 100,000 miles, using it as a second car. He attributed the frugality less to his upbringing than to a lack of imagination about things to do with money. His later years were also a time of growing professional recognition, the Inventors Hall of Fame, the National Medal of Science, the National Medal of Technology, and the award of the National Academy of Engineering, the Charles Stark Draper Medal. The capstone of recognition came in 2000, when he was awarded half of the Nobel Prize in Physics for having, quote, laid the foundation of modern information technology. With typical graciousness, he noted that Noyce, had he still been alive, would undoubtedly also have shared the prize. After a brief battle with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, Kilby died on the 20th of June 2005 at his home in Dallas, Texas. According to Willis Adcock, his original boss at Texas Instrument, Kilby succeeded because of his good creative sense and his ability to integrate a broad knowledge of mathematics and materials. Kilby defined himself not as a scientist who seeks to explain things, but as an engineer whose drive is to solve problems, to make something work. That is basically what I've always wanted to do, he said, to solve technical problems. It is quite satisfying, extremely satisfying, to go through the process and find a solution that works. The most fun, he remembered, was the integrated circuit and its consequences, the most fun by far. Even while he was working on the invention with no idea of its future impact, it was exciting, challenging, demanding. You have been listening to Computing Lives. This podcast was based on an essay published in the January 2007 issue of the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. It was written by Peter Eckstein. The music for this podcast came from the Pod Show PodSafe Music Network. You can find it at music.podshow.com. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you next time.